Chapter 80. And her religion? That can't last, said Hans. SG will see no Jew who is tolerable. Every male of that race is insupportable, insupportably advancing his nose. She may rejoin her family. That is what she longs for. Her mother and brother are probably strict Jews. I'll turn proselyte, if she wishes it, said Hans, with a shrug and a laugh. Don't talk nonsense, Hans. I thought you professed a serious love for her, said Deronda, getting heated. So I do. You think it desperate, but I don't. I know nothing. I can't tell what has happened. We must be prepared for surprises. But I can hardly imagine a greater surprise to me than that there should have seemed to be anything in Mira's sentiments for you to found a romantic hope on. Deronda felt that he was too contemptuous. I don't found my romantic hopes on a woman's sentiments, said Hans, perversely inclined to be the merrier when he was addressed with gravity. I go to science and philosophy for my romance. Nature designed Mira to fall in love with me. The amalgamation of races demands it, the mitigation of human ugliness demands it, the affinity of contrasts assures it. I am the utmost contrast to Mira, a bleached Christian, who can't sing two notes in tune. Who has a chance against me? I see now, it was all persiflage. You don't mean a word you say, Merrick, said Deronda, laying his hand on Merrick's shoulder, and speaking in a tone of cordial relief. I was a wiseacre to answer you seriously. Upon my honor I do mean it, though, said Hans, facing round and laying his left hand on Deronda's shoulder, so that their eyes fronted each other closely. I am at the confessional. I meant to tell you, as soon as you came. My mother says you are Mira's guardian, and she thinks herself responsible to you for every breath that falls on Mira in her house. Well, I love her, I worship her, I won't despair, I mean to deserve her. My dear fellow, you can't do it, said Deronda, quickly. I should have said, I mean to try. You can't keep your resolve, Hans. You used to resolve what you would do for your mother and sisters. You have a right to reproach me, old fellow, said Hans, gently. Perhaps I am ungenerous, said Deronda, not apologetically, however. Why yet it can't be ungenerous to warn you that you are indulging mad, quixotic expectations. Who will be hurt but myself, then? Said Hans, putting out his lip. I am not going to say anything to her unless I felt sure of the answer. I dare not ask the oracles. I prefer a cheerful collegianosity, as Sir Thomas Browne might say. I would rather run my chance there and lose than be sure of winning anywhere else. And I don't mean to swallow the poison of despair, though you are disposed to thrust it on me. I am giving up wine, so let me get a little drunk on hope and vanity. With all my heart, if it will do you any good, said Deronda, loosing Hans's shoulder with a little push. He made his tone kindly, but his words were from the lip only. As to his real feeling, he was silenced. He was conscious of that peculiar irritation which will sometimes befall the man whom others are inclined to trust as a mentor, the irritation of perceiving that he is supposed to be entirely off the same plane of desire and temptation as those who confess to him. Our guides, we pretend, must be sinless. As if those were not often the best teachers who only yesterday got corrected for their mistakes. Throughout their friendship, Deronda had been used to Hans's egotism, but he had never before felt intolerant of it. When Hans, habitually pouring out his own feelings and affairs, had never cared for any detail in return, and, if he chanced to know any, and soon forgotten it. Deronda had been inwardly as well as outwardly indulgent, nay, satisfied. But now he had noted with some indignation, all the stronger, because it must not be betrayed, Hans's evident assumption that for any danger of rivalry or jealousy in relation to Mira, Deronda was not as much out of the question as the angel Gabriel. It is one thing to be resolute in placing oneself out of the question, and another to endure that others should perform that exclusion for us. He had expected that Hans would give him trouble. What he had not expected was that the trouble would have a strong element of personal feeling. And he was rather ashamed that Hans's hoax caused him uneasiness in spite of his well-warranted conviction that they would never be fulfilled. They had raised an image of Mira changing, and however he might protest that the change would not happen, the protest kept up the unpleasant image. Altogether, poor Hans seemed to be entering into Deronda's experience in a disproportionate manner, going beyond his part of rescued prodigal, and rousing a feeling quite distinct from compassionate affection. When Deronda went to Chelsea, he was not made as comfortable as he ought to have been by Mrs. Merrick's evident release from anxiety about the beloved but incalculable son. Mira seemed livelier than before, and for the first time he saw her laugh. It was when they were talking of Hans, he being naturally the mother's first topic. Mira wished to know if Deronda had seen Mr. Hans going through a sort of character piece without changing his dress. He passes from one figure to another, as if he were a bit of flame, where you fancied the figures without seeing them, said Mira, full of her subject. He is so wonderfully quick. I used never to like comic things on the stage, they were dwelt on too long. But all in 1 minute Mr. Hans makes himself a blind bard, and then Ryan's eye addressing the Romans, and then an opera dancer, and then a desponding young gentleman. I am sorry for them all, and yet I laugh. All in one here Mira gave a little laugh that might have entered into a song. We hardly thought that Mira could laugh till Hans came, said Mrs. Merrick, seeing that Deronda, like herself, was observing the pretty picture. Hans seems in great force just now, said Deronda in a tone of congratulation. I don't wonder it is enlivening you. He's been just perfect ever since he came back, said Mrs. Merrick, keeping to herself the next clause, effort will but last. It is a great happiness, said Mira, to see the son and brother come into this dear home. And I hear them all talk about what they did together when they were little. That seems like heaven, and to have a mother and brother who talk in that way. I have never had it. Nor I, said Deronda, involuntarily. No, said Mira, regretfully. I wish you had. I wish you had had every good. The last words were uttered with a serious ardor, as if they had been part of a litany, while her eyes were fixed on Deronda, who with his elbow on the back of his chair, was contemplating her by the new light of the impressioness he had made on Hans, and the possibility of her being attracted by that extraordinary contrast. It was no more than what had happened on each former visit of his, that Mira appeared to enjoy speaking of what she felt very much as a little girl fresh from school, pours forth spontaneously all the long repressed chat for which she has found willing ears. For the first time in her life Mira was among those whom she entirely trusted, and her original visionary impression, that Deronda was a divinely sent messenger, hung about his image still, stirring always anew the disposition to reliance and openness. It was in this way she took what might have been the injurious flattery of admiring attention into which her helpless dependence had been suddenly transformed. Everyone around her watched for her looks and words, and the effect on her was simply that of having passed from a trifling imprisonment into an exhilarating air which made speech and action a delight. To her mind it was all a gift from others' goodness. But that word of Deronda's implying that there had been some lack in his life which might be compared with anything as he had known in hers, was an entirely new inlet of thought about him. After her first expression of sorrowful surprise she went on, but Mr. Hans said yesterday that you thought so much of others you hardly wanted anything for yourself. He told us a wonderful story of Buddha giving himself to the famished tigress to save her and her little ones from starving. And he said you were like Buddha. That is what we all imagine of you. Pray don't imagine that, said Deronda, who had lately been finding such suppositions rather exasperating. Even if it were true that I thought so much of others, it would not follow that I had no wants for myself. When Buddha let the tigress eat him, he might have been very hungry himself. Perhaps if he was starved he would not mind, so much about being eaten, said Mab, shyly. Please don't think that, Mab. It takes away the beauty of the action, said Mira. But if it were true, Mira, said the rational Amy, having a half holiday from her teaching, you always take what is beautiful, as if it were true. So it is, said Mira, gently. If people have thought what is the most beautiful and the best thing, it must be true. It is always there. Now, Mira, what do you mean? Said Amy. I understand her, said Deronda, coming to the rescue. It is a truth in thought, though it may never have been carried out in action. It lives as an idea. Is that it? He turned to Mira, who was listening with a blind look in her lovely eyes. It must be that, because you understand me, but I cannot quite explain, said Mira, rather abstractedly, still searching for some expression. But was it beautiful for Buddha to let the tiger eat him? Said Amy, changing her ground. It would be a bad pattern. The world would get full of fat tigers, said Mab. Deronda laughed, but defended the myth. It is like a passionate word, he said. The exaggeration is a flash of fervor. It is an extreme image of what is happening every day, the transmutation of self. I think I can say what I mean now, said Mira, who had not heard the intermediate talk. When the best thing comes into our thoughts, it is like what my mother has been to me. She has been just as really with me as all the other people about me, often more really with me. Deronda, inwardly wincing under this illustration, which brought other possible realities about that mother vividly before him, presently turned the conversation by saying, but we must not get too far away from practical matters. I came, for one thing, to tell of an interview I had yesterday, which I hope Mira will find to have been useful to her. It was with Klezmer, the great pianist. Said Mrs. Merrick, with satisfaction. You think he will help her? I hope so. He is very much occupied, but has promised to fix a time for receiving and hearing Miss Lapidus. As we must learn to call her here, Deronda smiled at Mira if she consents to go to him. I shall be very grateful, said Mira. He wants to hear me sing, before he can judge whether I ought to be helped. Deronda was struck with her plain sense about these matters of practical concern. It will not be at all trying to you, I hope, if Mrs. Merrick will kindly go with you to Klezmer's house. Oh, no, not at all trying. I have been doing that all my life, told to do things that others may judge of me. And I have gone through a bad trial of that sort. I am prepared to bear it and do some very small thing. Is Klezmer a severe man? He is peculiar, but I have not had experience enough of him to know whether he would be what you would call severe. I know he is kind-hearted, kind in action, if not in speech. I have been used to be frowned at and not praised, said Mira. By the by, Klezmer frowns a good deal, said Deronda, but there is often a sort of smile in his eyes all the while. Unhappily he wears spectacles, so you must catch him in the right light to see the smile. I shall not be frightened, said Mira. If he were like a roaring lion, he only wants me to sing. I shall do what I can. Then I feel sure you will not mind being invited to sing in Lady Malinger's drawing room, said Deronda. She intends to ask you next month, and will invite many ladies to hear you, who are likely to want lessons from you for their daughters. How fast we are mounting, said Mrs. Merrick, with delight. You never thought of getting grand so quickly, Mira. I am a little frightened at being called Miss Lapidus, said Mira, coloring with a new uneasiness. Might I be called Cohen? I understand you, said Deronda, promptly. But I assure you, you must not be called Cohen. The name is inadmissible for a singer. This is as one of the trifles in which we must conform to vulgar prejudice. We could choose some other name, however, such as singers ordinarily choose an Italian or Spanish name, which would suit your physique. To Deronda just now, the name Cohen was equivalent to the ugliest of yellow badges. Mira reflected a little, anxiously, then said, no. If Cohen will not do, I will keep the name I have been called by. I will not hide myself. I have friends to protect me. And now if my father were very miserable and wanted help, no, she said, looking at Mrs. Merrick, I should think then that he was perhaps crying as I used to see him and had nobody to pity him, and I had hidden myself from him. He had none belonging to him but me. Others that made friends with him always left him. Keep to what you feel right, my dear child, said Mrs. Merrick. I would not persuade you to the contrary. For her own part, as he had no patience or pity for that father, and would have left him to his crying. Deronda was saying to himself, I am rather base to be angry with Hans. How can he help being in love with her? But it is too absurdly presumptuous for him even to frame the idea of appropriating her, and a sort of blasphemy to suppose that she could possibly give herself to him. What would it be for Daniel Deronda to entertain such thoughts? He was not one who could quite naively introduce himself where he had just excluded his friend, yet it was undeniable that what had just happened made a new stage in his feeling toward Mira. But apart from other grounds for self-repression, reasons both definite and vague made him shut away that question as he might have shut up a half-opened writing that would have carried his imagination too far and given too much shape to presentiments. Might there not come a disclosure which would hold the missing determination of his course? What did he really know about his origin? Strangely, in these latter months when it seemed right that he should exert his will in the choice of a destination, the passion of his nature had got more and more locked by this uncertainty. The disclosure might bring its pain, indeed the likelihood seemed to him to be all on that side. But if it helped him to make his life a sequence which would take the form of duty, if it saved him from having to make an arbitrary selection, where he felt no preponderance of desire. Still more, he wanted to escape standing as a critic outside the activities of men, stiffened into the ridiculous attitude of self-assigned superiority. His chief tether was his early inward affection for Sir Hugo, making him gratefully deferential to wishes with which he had little agreement. But gratitude had been sometimes disturbed by doubts which were near reducing it to a fear of being ungrateful. Many of us complain that half our birthright is sharp duty. Deronda was more inclined to complain that he was robbed of this half, yet he accused himself, as he would have accused another, of being weakly self-conscious and wanting in resolve. He was the reverse of that type painted for us in Falconbridge and Edmund of Gloucester, whose coarse ambition for personal success is inflamed by a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.